Human rights groups say that poor countries could be left behind as rich nations are hoarding coronavirus vaccines. The British Prime Minister Boris Johnson says no British leader could accept the current demands of the European Union over a post-Brexit trade deal. And Iran's president says that the Islamic Republic will fulfill its obligations under the 2015 nuclear deal once other signatories live up to their commitments. Warm welcome to our studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is News. Thanks for joining us. Several human rights groups have expressed concerns over rich nations' rush for coronavirus vaccines, warning that poor countries could be left behind in getting doses that they require. The warning came from the People's Vaccine Alliance, a coalition including Oxfam, Amnesty International, and Global Justice Now. It said that only 1 in 10 people in dozens of poor nations could be vaccinated, as wealthy countries have hoarded far more doses to immunize the population by the end of 2021. Campaigners noted the rich nations have bought up to 53% of the vaccine so far, while they comprise of only 14% of the global population. Rights groups called on governments and pharmaceutical industries to make sure the vaccines are available and accessible to all. The number of confirmed coronavirus cases in Europe has surpassed the grim milestone of 20 million, as the continent is struggling with a second wave of the disease. Russia registered over 26,000 new cases, taking the national toll to over 2.5 million since the pandemic began. Authorities also reported 559 new coronavirus-related deaths in the last 24 hours. Germany on Wednesday reported a new daily record of 590 new deaths. That brings the country's overall death toll to almost 20,000. Meanwhile, German Chancellor Angela Merkel has demanded stricter curbs amid the upcoming holiday season to slow the virus surge in the country.
We are living in a pandemic, and that means we are living in extraordinary circumstances. We are living in a situation where we are facing challenges that Germany has never had to deal with before. And we need to respond to these extraordinary circumstances with extraordinary measures.
Merkel also said that a complete lockdown would include closing shops after Christmas, adding the vaccines alone would not majorly alter the pandemic's course. The virus surge in recent weeks has prompted Germany to extend a partial lockdown until January the 10th. Also on Wednesday, Ukraine registered a record number of daily deaths with 276 new fatalities. The country also recorded more than 12,000 cases in 24 hours. Europe is the worst affected by the pandemic, accounting for 40% of the new cases reported worldwide in the past 7 days. Brussels correspondent Jerome Hughes says the high daily coronavirus death toll remains a major concern in EU countries, despite a falling infection rate there.
She said in the German parliament this morning that, you know, Germany will not survive the winter unless it brings in more draconian measures in terms of restrictions. Now, we have seen that these measures have worked elsewhere within the European Union. In terms of the transmission rate of the disease, the figures are going in the right direction in many countries. But then when you look at the death toll, I mean, you mentioned Germany's death toll, but also Italy in the past 24 hours, 634 people dying, UK 616, Poland 568, France 490. So these are huge death tolls in any given 24-hour period. So while the transmission rate is going down, as I say, in many places, the death toll is still very bad. And one statistic that stands out to me in my mind is Stella Kariakias, the EU Health Commissioner, last week. She says that somebody is dying in the European Union from coronavirus every 17 seconds. So obviously it's a major concern, especially now that we have the holiday period coming up towards the end of the year, and there will be a lot of people congregating. Even though the cafes, restaurants and social places are closed in many countries, including here in Belgium, people will be gathering indoors, closely confined spaces during the holiday period, and there is concern then that hospitals will be overwhelmed.
The UK Premier says no British leader could accept the current demands of the European Union for a post-Brexit trade deal.
Our friends in the EU are currently insisting that if they pass a new law in the future, with which we in this country do not comply or don't follow suit, then they want the automatic right, Mr. Speaker, to punish us and to retaliate. And secondly, they're saying that the UK should be the only country in the world not to have sovereign control over its fishing waters. And I don't believe, Mr. Speaker, that those are terms that any Prime Minister of this country should accept.
Boris Johnson was speaking in Parliament hours before heading to Brussels to meet the European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen. Early in the day, the German Chancellor said that a deal on future trade is only possible if Britain prevents unfair competition with the EU. Angela Merkel noted that Germany would accept a no-deal outcome if London does not give ground. Britain left the EU in January. It is now in a transition period that expires on December the 31st. And that is also the deadline for reaching a deal on future trade ties. Richard Sudan says that the possibility of a no-deal Brexit will have a massive detrimental impact on the life of Britons.
So, I mean, you know, Angela Merkel has talked about regulatory standards as kind of one of the obstacles to be talked about in the coming days. But the reality for anyone that's really been paying close attention here is that the United Kingdom has basically wasted all the time it's had over the last few months and indeed years. And in some ways, this was predictable. You know, many people believed really from Johnson's beginning of his tenure a year or so ago. Of course, he made the entire general election about Brexit. And here we are, you know, reaching the penultimate hour, and these details are still not clear, and the sort of possibility of a no-deal Brexit is, you know, ever closer. I mean, I think the irony, if you like, is many of the sort of kind of working class areas in England, the former so-called Red Wall, actually it's going to be some of the poorest and most marginalised communities that are going to feel the very immediate effects of Brexit, for example, in terms of food shortages or, say, medicine shortages. And of course, you know, let's not forget, freedom of movement is going to end for many immigrants that call Britain their home. And this policy in itself is going to have a massive economic impact, a massive, I would say, detrimental social impact. So I think, you know, one metaphor I've heard is, you know, Britain cutting off its nose to spite its face. The very real effects of Brexit are going to be kicking in now, a hard Brexit or not. And it's going to be many of the same people that voted for Brexit that are going to feel those effects in the immediate term.
The running president says that the possible return of the incoming U.S. administration to the 2015 nuclear deal neither needs negotiations nor takes time.
As I said before, it will take no time for both sides to return to their commitments. It just needs a will. How was the nuclear deal undermined? That illiterate businessman scrawled his signature on a piece of paper. It all happened with a scrawl. He brought some paper, scrawled his signature, and announced that he walked out of the nuclear deal. Now the next person can sign a good sheet of paper. It just needs a signature, and you're back to square one. It is as easy as this. It won't take time, nor does it require negotiations.
Rouhani was referring to U.S. President Donald Trump, who pulled out of the nuclear accord in 2018 and reimposed sanctions on Iran. He urged U.S. President-elect Joe Biden to rejoin the agreement and make up for the harms that Trump did to the Iranian nation. Rouhani stressed that Iran will resume the full implementation of the nuclear deal once all other parties live up to their obligations. He said that Iran's reduction of commitments, including the installation of advanced centrifuges at its Natanz facility, can be reversed quickly. Political commentator Edward Corrigan believes that Biden will throw out what he calls Trump's legacy of poison vis-a-vis Iran once he takes office.
If Biden, soon to be elected and confirmed, he can simply, you know, throw out the Trump legacy of poison and bring it back and have a constructive engagement and signal a break between his administration and Donald Trump's administration and various policies and shenanigans that he employed to basically disrupt things. He creates chaos, and then out of chaos he seeks some sort of opportunity. But the Iranians are still abiding by the agreement. They've only taken a few small steps, which they are entitled to under Section 24 and 34 of the agreement, and they have, you know, at least lukewarm and you know, vocal support from the Europeans, as well as very strong support from the Russians and Chinese. So yes, I think this is a good opportunity for Biden to break a long string of chain of negative events that Donald Trump created, and to put the Iranian government and the other partners with this agreement back up to where they were before Donald Trump took over and destroyed the agreement.
Afghanistan's defense ministry says two security forces have been killed in an attack in the eastern province of Ghazni. The ministry says the attack targeted a military base and left three others wounded. It has blamed the assault on the Taliban militant group. The ministry said three militants were killed in ensuing clashes. The incident came just days after the Afghan government and the Taliban agreed to continue peace talks. They began the negotiations in Qatar in September with the final goal of ending the years-long war in Afghanistan. The talks, however, have failed to reduce violence. Less than 2 weeks ago, a suicide attack killed 31 people in Ghazni. It was blamed on the Taliban. Damien Alami earlier joined us from Kabul and gave details of the attack in Ghazni province.
This incident happened in Ghazni, the capital city of Ghazni province in southern Afghanistan. According to military sources there, two terrorists had planned to launch twin-track bomb blasts on an Afghan army base in Mullah Nuh Baba area of this city in southern Afghanistan, but Afghan forces identified them and opened fire on them. As a result, the driver of one of the trucks that was full of explosives were killed, and his truck was also exploded, and the second driver was escaped.
In March of last year, a terrorist attack hit two mosques in New Zealand's Christchurch. 51 people were killed after white supremacists opened fire at Muslim worshippers during Friday prayers. Now a government inquiry has concluded that there were severe failings by authorities ahead of the attack.
March the 15th, 2019, saw one of the world's bloodiest massacres in modern history when Brenton Tarrant, a white supremacist, walked into Christchurch Mosque and opened fire on worshippers, armed with automatic weapons that left many dead and a society deeply scarred. Following an extensive inquiry by the New Zealand authorities, the final report has suggested that there was a series of failures ahead of the incident that, although may not have prevented the attack, has certainly left many lessons to be learned for the future. It left the Prime Minister of New Zealand, Jacinda Ardern, apologising for the failings and claiming that measures will be taken to prevent such acts in the future. One of the main findings, and something that's no doubt valid for countries across the globe, is the institutional racism that occurred prior to the attack, as well as an unconscious bias, which is embedded into Western security and police services. Yet in spite of multiple warnings by the Muslim community in New Zealand regarding a rise in hate crime, it appears that nothing was done. So why then were the allegations being made, not taken seriously by those that should have? Yet the sad truth is that it's not just New Zealand that's seeing a rise in hatred against Muslims, as Islamophobia is on the rise across the world, with cases clear in Europe, the US, France, India, and beyond.
Islamophobia, this crime, this hate crime, should be defined very precisely and should be adopted as a law in every country, because it's distorted, and they don't know what is Islamophobia, and people are swinging right and left and hitting the Muslims, in media and everywhere, and they're getting away with it. And it's the hatred against Muslims is growing in a lot of places, and the Muslims are becoming, a lot of them, not all of them obviously, are becoming immune to these attacks. It's become a normality because they're trying to adopt these Western governments and Western societies, and they're overlooking some of them, these issues. But these issues, they accumulate and they start to grow problems, and eventually we see the results as the New Zealand Christchurch attack, or the attack in Quebec.
Well, the inquiry by the New Zealand government found intelligence failures on known extremists and an indoctrinated racial bias among authorities. The inquiry also criticized authorities for ignoring repeated warnings from the Muslim community on rising hate crimes against them. Now, with the cases of Islamophobia on the rise around the globe, can world leaders and communities come together to fight the surge? Can they build a world with integration and tolerance in mind?
One only has to look at the latest action movies and video games hitting the screens to see that racism is rife across the world, in particular when it comes to anti-Islamic sentiments, with the stereotypical bad guy being cast as a Muslim extremist. Furthermore, anti-Islamic feelings have been demonstrated in France with the publication of offensive cartoons portraying the Prophet Muhammad, which, having been published in magazines, shows another medium in which Islamophobia exists. Yet it's how different leaders are dealing with the issue that truly dictates how a nation will come together to fight religious discrimination, with Jacinda Ardern of New Zealand fully supporting the Muslim community, whilst President Emmanuel Macron in France labelled the act of publishing cartoons as free speech. So with the world so openly exposed to such hatred through a variety of mediums, how then can the problem be addressed?
In regards to this question, it's very clear that for many, many years, the media has been exploiting, the way to criticize Muslims, you know, by labeling them, for instance, as Islamists or terrorists, that they are a threat to, for instance, the Western governments and the social lifestyle here inside the West. And this has become now a normality. You know, people listen to it all the time in media. These Islamists, these Muslims, these people are coming from war-torn countries, and they're trying to impose their Sharia laws, for instance. I mean, this continues on in all the media all the time. And nobody holds them accountable for using such labels on people.
One of the main methods for fighting such acts is to lead from the top. Therefore, the example of how to embrace integration, equality, and anti-racist sentiments should be demonstrated to the public by world leaders. Yet with the likes of Macron, Trump, and many others both publicly and privately glued to their discriminatory views, there has to be a change at the top before the idea finally trickles down to the masses.
The UN Human Rights Chief has expressed optimism about U.S. President-elect Joe Biden's pledges to halt the separation of migrant families. Michelle Bachelet called Biden's vows to set up a task force to reunite the separated family members promising. Hundreds of migrant kids have been separated from their parents under Donald Trump administration's so-called zero-tolerance policy. The strategy was scrapped in 2018 amid international outcry. Bachelet has also expressed hope that Biden will implement his pledges to reverse other Trump-era policies, which she said have serious setbacks for human rights. She named women and journalists as groups that have suffered under Trump. Bachelet also welcomed Biden's promises to address systemic racism within the U.S. and rejoin the Paris Climate Accord and the World Health Organization. And that does it for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5 and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you. the limelight. Reaffirming its unwavering support for the Zionist regime of Israel, the United States took radical steps to reject International Criminal Court's authority over its citizens and territory, suspend visas to International Criminal Court's personnel and their families, and condemn the Palestine investigation and any other action that seeks to target Israel. U.S. Hawks Secretary of State Mike Pompeo has repeatedly and wrongly referred to the court, the ICC, as an embarrassing political renegade and unlawful so-called court and a vehicle for political vendettas, masquerading as a legal body. In order to shield U.S. and Zionist regime occupiers who have committed war crimes, U.S. President Donald Trump even issued an executive order imposing sanctions on the ICC prosecutor and ICC investigators. Some commentators have expressed doubt that Joe Biden, who has been projected by the U.S. media as the winner of the 2020 presidential election, will be willing or able to reverse this course of action and hostility towards international justice. Confronted by a deluge of politically motivated accusations, the International Criminal Court need not sink to the level of its detractors. Its founding treaty, the Rome Statute, requires the court to stand for justice, determined to put an end to impunity for the perpetrators of international crimes. We're prepared for you an article written by Raji Surani, the director of the Palestinian Center for Human Rights based in the Gaza Strip. The piece is titled Palestinian Case at ICC Legal, Not Political. The article has been taken from the AlJazeera.com website. Please stay with us for more of Raji Surani's article. It took International Criminal Court ICC Chief Prosecutor Fatou Bensouda 5 years to conclude her preliminary examination of the situation in Palestine, which found a reasonable basis to believe that war crimes have indeed been or are being committed in the occupied West Bank, including in Eastern Al-Quds and the Gaza Strip, and thus to initiate an investigation. Fatou Bensouda's statement on 20th of December 2019, announcing the end of the inquiry, was met with widespread enthusiasm by victims and human rights organizations alike, but the celebrations came too soon. The ICC prosecutor found that the standard of proof for the commission of war crimes was met, and that opening the investigation was appropriate and in the interest of justice. Nevertheless, instead of proceeding, she sought confirmation on the scope of the ICC's territorial jurisdiction from the pretrial chamber. She asked the chamber to take a decision within 120 days. Nearly a year later, victims are still waiting for that decision. As a Palestinian lawyer in the Gaza Strip, I've spent 30 years representing victims of war crimes and crimes against humanity across the occupied Palestinian territories. Since 2009, I have represented the Palestinian victims of Israeli crimes in Gaza before the International Criminal Court, the ICC. Our last resort to ensure the most serious crimes of concern to the international community do not go unpunished. Today, I'm increasingly frustrated by the court's painfully slow progress. It is true that international criminal proceedings are typically longer than domestic cases, but it is hard to understand why the substantive investigations into the crimes committed in occupied Palestine have not commenced, despite the evidence uncovered in the prosecutor's preliminary examination. The International Criminal Court prosecutor's decision to ask the pretrial chamber to confirm territorial jurisdiction in Palestine
and consequent delays risk jeopardizing the effectiveness of the investigation. This wasted precious time and has played into the hands of certain political actors who have attempted to detract from the seriousness of the court's preliminary findings of war crimes. Most notably, the Israeli Foreign Affairs Ministry has published a position paper which attempts to divert attention away from the gravity of the crimes which have been committed and direct it towards the old question, is Palestine even a state? This argument champions a legal and moral absurdity. There can be no victims of war crimes in Palestine if Palestine is not a state. In January, the pretrial chamber issued a call for the submission of observations on the question of jurisdiction. In response 43, Amici Curiae legal opinions were submitted from third states, international organizations, legal scholars, and civil society by the 16th of March deadline. Most submissions did not limit themselves to the technical question of territorial jurisdiction as requested, but interpreted this moment as an opportunity to make claims about the statehood of Palestine, the legitimacy of the proceedings, and their political appropriateness. However, the chamber did not follow up with a timely delivery of its judgment. The politicization of this case engulfed the International Criminal Court proceedings from the very beginning, echoing the fate of previous attempts to seek redress for violations of international law in Palestine through legal mechanisms and forums. A delegitimization campaign was launched against the court, with accusations ranging from taking a political stand to espousing anti-Semitic positions. Reaffirming its unwavering support for the Zionist regime of Israel, the United States of America took radical steps to reject International Criminal Court authority over its citizens and territory, to suspend visas to ICC personnel and their families, and to condemn the Palestine investigation and any other action that seeks to target the Israeli regime. U.S. Hawk Secretary of State Mike Pompeo has repeatedly and wrongly referred to the ICC as an embarrassing political renegade and unlawful so-called court and a vehicle for political vendettas masquerading as a legal body. In order to shield U.S. and Zionist regime occupiers from committed war crimes, U.S. President Donald Trump even issued an executive order imposing sanctions on the International Criminal Court prosecutors and investigators. Some commentators have expressed doubt that Joe Biden, who has been projected by the U.S. media as the winner of the 2020 presidential election, will be willing or able to reverse this course of action and hostility towards international justice. Confronted by a deluge of politically motivated accusations, the International Criminal Court need not sink to the level of its detractors. Its founding treaty, the Rome Statute, requires the court to stand for justice, determined to put an end to impunity for the perpetrators of international crimes. The only valid approach is for the International Criminal Court, the ICC, to tackle the question as a strictly legal one. In this sense, in concluding her preliminary examination satisfactorily, the ICC prosecutor could have opened the investigation directly. There was no legal requirement to submit a request to clarify the territorial jurisdiction of the ICC, the International Criminal Court. Therefore, her request has brought a heated political debate into the courtroom. Resolving it once and for all at the preliminary stage of the proceedings will avoid incertitude and more unbearable delays in the decision. This strictly judicial approach is not divorced from the reality on the ground. Instead, it acknowledges the critical situation of the victims of Israeli occupation, for whom this court represents the only and last resort. Abandoned by the international community, unable to access any Israeli foreign or international tribunal, and subjected to a cruel occupation, the fate of the Palestinian people is now more than ever tied to that of the International Criminal Court, the ICC. Now the court is at a crossroads. It can yield and collapse under Israeli and US pressure, or it can choose to act upon its object and purpose to ensure that international crimes committed against Palestinians do not go unpunished.
This is A to Z. An introduction to Islamic lifestyle. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Most Beneficent, the Most Merciful. Dear brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum. Peace and blessings of Allah be upon you all. This is A to Z, coming to you from IRIB English Radio, and I'm your host, Ali. This radio show is about Islamic lifestyle, and in each episode, we will be talking about a different lesson. Please stay with us till the end of today's program. Today's lesson, what is the price of a human? Usually when somebody is asked about the price of his life, he cannot name a price. No price is high enough. You cannot really put a price tag on your life, on your existence. However, in reality, when you ask someone and they're not able to put this price tag, in reality, that person exchanges this precious life gradually, day by day, for a very small price indeed. Isn't that surprising? You hear this and you go like, no, not really. Well, lo and behold, he wakes up one fine day towards the end of his life to find that he has sold off his priceless asset in exchange for a house or a car or a country villa, which he will soon leave behind in any case when death comes to knock at his door. You know, how many of us, we have given our lives to corporate America, the multinationals. We work for their benefit. We work for their interest. They make the real money. We get the peanuts. They eat the meat, we have the bones. Why? Did we put a price tag on our life or not? Think about it. This is where the material lifestyle is taking us, that materialism is pulling us towards all that, right? And this is where it's crucial to look at Quran and Ahlul Bayt alayhi salatu wasalam, because they've given us and they've informed us how we're supposed to look at this world and how we're supposed to live this life. We're going to go for a short break and then we'll inform you of a hadith of Imam Ali alayhi salam, where he informs us of what our price should be. Welcome back to your listeners. We were talking about the price tag that we can put on our lives. And we said that everybody, more or less, ends up putting a price tag on his or her life. Imam Ali alayhi salam says that nothing whatsoever of the material treasures of this world is worthy enough to be exchanged with the capital of your life. The only thing worth selling your life for is God's satisfaction, human and spiritual development, that leads to an everlasting prosperity in paradise. This is the thing to buy with your life. It is worthy of every endeavor, attempt, and sacrifice one can make. This is that real investment that you should be doing. You know how we look at the return on investment when we're going to put in some wealth in exchange of, you know, buying something? This is where we should consider that if we are putting a price tag on our lives, what are we selling it for? What is the return on this investment of my asset, that is my life? What do I get in return? This is something for you and me and all of us to take into consideration. Imam Ali alayhi salam said, "Beware, no price is good enough for you except everlasting prosperity and paradise. So do not exchange it for any other price." So the least price tag that you should put on yourself is prosperity and paradise. Yes, you go ahead and sell your life for or in exchange of paradise, but don't sell it for anything less. It's not worth it. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's episode of A to Z. Don't forget to log on to our website at www.parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you all in the care of Allah. Till next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Attorney General William P. Barr is considering stepping down before President Trump's term ends next month, according to three people familiar with this thinking. One said Mr. Barr could announce his departure before the end of this year. It was not clear whether the Attorney General's deliberations were influenced by Mr. Trump's refusal to concede his election loss or his fury over William Barr's acknowledgement last week that the Justice Department uncovered no widespread voting fraud. In the ensuing days, the president refused to say whether he still had confidence in his Attorney General. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalists Katie Benner, Michael Schmidt, and Peter Baker. The piece is titled, Barr is said to be weighing whether to leave before Trump's term ends. Attorney General William P. Barr is considering stepping down before President Trump's term ends next month, according to three people familiar with this thinking. One said William Barr could announce his departure before the end of this month. It was not clear whether the Attorney General's deliberations were influenced by Mr. Trump's refusal to concede his election loss, or his fury over William Barr's acknowledgement last week that the Justice Department uncovered no widespread voting fraud. In the ensuing days, the president refused to say whether he still had confidence in his Attorney General. One of the people insisted that Mr. Barr had been weighing his departure since before last week, and that Mr. Trump had not affected the Attorney General's thinking. Another said Mr. Barr had concluded that he had completed the work that he set out to accomplish at the Justice Department. But the president's public complaints about the election, including a baseless allegation earlier last week that federal law enforcement had rigged the election against him, are certain to cast a cloud over any early departure by William Barr. By leaving early, Mr. Barr could avoid a confrontation with the president over his refusal to advance Donald Trump's efforts to rewrite the election results. Mr. Barr's departure would also deprive the president of a cabinet officer who has wielded the power of the Justice Department more deeply in service of a president's political agenda than any attorney general in the past half a century. Conversely, it would please some Trump allies who have called for Mr. Barr to step down over his refusal to wade further into Donald Trump's efforts to overturn the election outcome. Mr. Barr has not made a final decision, and the prospect of him staying on through to 20th of January remains a possibility, people familiar with his thinking have cautioned. Should William Barr step down before the end of the Trump administration, the Deputy Attorney General, Jeffrey A. Rosen, would be expected to lead the Justice Department until President-elect Joseph R. Biden is sworn in. A Justice Department spokeswoman declined to comment. William Barr, 70 years old, is the strongest proponent of presidential power to hold the office of Attorney General since Watergate. Soon after he was confirmed in February of 2019, he gained Donald Trump's trust and his ear. He managed to heal fissures between the White House and the Justice Department that broke open when the president learned that his campaign was under investigation by the FBI relating to Russia's interference in the 2016 presidential election. Like Donald Trump, William Barr believed that the FBI had abused its power in investigating the Trump campaign's ties to Russia. An independent inspector general has found that the Bureau had sufficient reason to open the inquiry and that senior officials at the FBI acted without political bias in doing so. but weeks after taking office, William Barr released summary of the report by the special counsel, Robert S. Mueller III, that a judge later called distorted and misleading. William Barr presented it in the best possible light for Donald Trump before the public could actually read the report. William Barr soon asked John H. Durham, the U.S. attorney in Connecticut, to open an investigation into the Russia inquiry itself to seek out any wrongdoing under the Obama administration. While that investigation has not yet produced the kind of results that Donald Trump has explicitly said he would like to see, including criminal charges against former President Barack Obama and former Vice President Joe Biden, as well as the former FBI Director James Comey. William Barr has ensured that Mr. Durham's work will continue into the next administration. In October, he secretly appointed Mr. Durham a special counsel assigned to seek out any wrongdoing in the course of the Russia investigation. William Barr revealed that appointment last week, at the same time that he said he had not seen evidence that voter fraud had affected the result of the presidential election. Pairing the Durham announcement with that revelation was widely seen as an effort to placate Donald Trump, who was said to be enraged that William Barr had publicly contradicted him. Throughout the presidential campaign, Mr. Barr was among the loudest voices warning that mail-in ballots would result in mass election fraud. He routinely claimed in speeches and interviews that the potential for widespread voter fraud was high and posed a grave danger. William Barr's claims were sometimes false or exaggerated and were widely refuted. "I don't have empirical evidence other than the fact that we've always had voting fraud, and there's always will be people who attempt to do that," William Barr said in September. He called his conclusions common sense. And after the election, William Barr opened the door to politically charged election fraud investigations, authorizing federal prosecutors to investigate specific allegations of voter fraud before results were certified. Typically, the Justice Department waits until after vote totals are certified to investigate such suspicions in order to avoid shaking public confidence in the elections. At the same time, Mr. Barr's public appearances dwindled, and he did not comment on the result or Donald Trump's attempts to overturn the outcome of the elections. But as the president's legal challenges hit a dead end, the pressure on William Barr to speak out increased. When Donald Trump suggested in an interview on 29th of November that the Justice Department and the FBI might have been involved in some sort of election fraud. "This is total fraud, and how the FBI and Department of Justice, I don't know, maybe they're involved, but how people are allowed to get away with this stuff is unbelievable," Donald Trump told the Fox Business Channel host Maria Bartiromo. William Barr broke his silence a few days later, telling the Associated Press that he had not seen evidence of election fraud on a scale that would have changed the fact that Joe Biden has won the election. "To date, we have not seen fraud on a scale that could have affected a different outcome in the election," he said. With Mr. Barr's departure, Donald Trump would lose the cabinet official who has carried out his agenda on policing, on racial unrest, affirmative action, and immigration. Unlike officials who have privately denigrated Donald Trump, department officials and friends say that William Barr agrees with most, if not all, of the president's positions, as well as his view that he was wronged by the Obama administration. William Barr himself has taken umbrage at the notion that his actions that helped Mr. Trump's allies, reducing a sentencing recommendation for the president's longtime friend, Roger Stone, on 7 felony convictions and seeking to withdraw the prosecution of Michael Flynn on charge of lying to investigators, were done at the president's behest. He has publicly and privately insisted that he would have made those moves no matter what, because he felt they were the right moves. When William Barr left the Justice Department in 1993, after serving as Attorney General under President George W. Bush, he became the General Counsel of the telecommunications company GTE Corp, which eventually became Verizon. That stint at the company ended with a $10.4 million payout and made him a millionaire many times over, making it unlikely that he will take another full-time job after he leaves the Justice Department.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 41 meters 7300 kHz for the Indian subcontinent and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5 and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Every night and every day, every night and every day, never forget to say, La ilaha illallah, never forget to say, La ilaha illallah.
IRIB English Radio, a herald of unity and solidarity amongst Islamic denominations.
Oh Lord, here I am, pleading at your door. Send me your mercy, send me your peace, or I am lost for sure.
Hadith of the day.
Here I am, yearning for your cure. This humble servant will be diverted from you no more, no more, no more.
You're listening to the program Hadith of the Day on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Yasser Ibrahim, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
A'udhu billahi min ash-shaytan ar-rajim. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين وصلى الله على سيدنا ونبينا ومولانا أبي القاسم المصطفى محمد وعلى أهل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين المعصومين السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته. Dear listeners, welcome to another episode of Hadith of the Day on IRIB English Radio. As mentioned in one of our previous episodes, the concept of pleasing Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala should be the objective of every single thing that we do. That qurbatulillah,
that getting closer to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, that proximity that we aim to acquire by doing certain actions, this qurb and this proximity and this nearness and this closeness that we aim to achieve is something of great importance, and we should not look at it in a very minute level. And on the flip side, we should not substitute people for Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And this can be seen in a very beautiful tradition from Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam, in which he mentions that. He mentions these two types of people and the results of the actions of these two types of people. That a person who pleases Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, in contrast to pleasing people, and on the other side, that a person pleases people in contrast to pleasing Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, or rather in conflict of what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala wants. So Imam Hussein alayhi salam is reported to have said that he who seeks to please Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala at the expense of displeasing people. So for example, a person asks a person to commit a sin, whatever that sin may be, and this person refuses, says, if I do this, I will displease Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. So he displeases this person, but Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is pleased with him in this regard, that he did not do that thing that he was asked to do, because he knew it will go against the divine law and the sharia of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. It's a very extreme example, but it gets the point across. Allah subhanahu, and then Imam Hussein continues that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala suffices him in everything, including his affairs with people. And Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala will give him everything. Because why? His goal was to please Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. His thought and his mind was always on what does Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala want from me in this situation. But again, on the other side, in a different situation, but the one who seeks to please people at the expense of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala's displeasure. So the same example, a person goes and does that particular act for the sake of pleasing that person, because he feels that person will give him something, you know, extra. You know, one example could be like in the workplace, you know, a person's manager or a person who's higher than you tells you to do something that you know goes against company policy or will bring a person into disrepute. And, you know, you do it. Why? Because you feel that by doing so, you will get a raise. However, there is also some other jurisprudential issues here, for example, forcing and so on, or what is known as ikrah, and so on and so forth. But that's a different issue altogether. But the Imam continues and says, but the one who seeks to please people at the expense of Allah's displeasure, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala will entrust this person to those very people. That Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala will say that, you know, you didn't want to please me. You wanted to please them. So seek your needs from those individuals. We ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to always enable us to please Him, to seek His pleasure, and to seek His nearness and qurb. Inshallah, until next time. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
That was the program Hadith of the Day on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Yasser Ibrahim, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
Oh here I am, pleading at your door. Send me your mercy, send me your peace, or I am lost for sure. Oh Lord, here I am, yearning for your cure. This humble servant will be diverted from you no more, no more.